The person that we hired to do the licensing for us, they got us like fake licenses, and we only found out later, and it ended up...
The cops show up and they're like, where's your license? And you show them the license.
Yeah, and they're like, this is not applicable to this zone. He got a license for some other part of Bombay, and then that became a mess that we had to sort out. That was a big learning, and definitely we got taken advantage of quite a few times.
Welcome to Millionaire Mondays, the show where we bring you the stories of real Indian startups told by the entrepreneurs that built them. I'm Caleb Friesen, and on the show today, how Matt Chittaranjan and Namrata Astana brought the specialty coffee segment to India for the very first time and built a 60-plus location chain of cafes called Blue Tokai. Coffee culture has existed in India for centuries, from its origins in Chikmagaluru, Karnataka in the 16th century, to export by the British in the 18th and 19th century, to modern consumption of coffee drinks across India, like, for example, cold coffee, South Indian filter coffee, and, of course, instant coffee. But before 2012, the concept of specialty coffee was almost unheard of in India. Brands like Cafe Coffee Day and Barista had popularized the concept of cafes as third spaces where people could sit down, read a book, or catch up with friends, and enjoy an affordable cup of espresso-based coffee, but the emphasis wasn't really on the coffee itself. The origin of the coffee in the consumer's cup was usually unknown to the consumer, the beans were heavily roasted to the point of being quite dark and bitter, and whatever natural bean flavor was left was usually masked by sugar and milk. And in the world of coffee culture, this is actually called second-wave coffee. And from the 1970s on, Starbucks was really the symbol for this second wave of coffee. They pioneered the concept of coffee as a vehicle for experience. You get this white cup with the green logo that you can show off in your selfies. You can sit down in their photogenic cafes and pretend to work on your laptop or have a meeting there to impress a client. And this was actually a massive departure from coffee's first wave, which mainly consisted of low-quality, cheap commodity coffee in the early and mid-20th century. So in 2011, third-wave coffee culture was in full swing in the United States and especially on the West Coast. Third-wave coffee companies focused on the coffee bean itself. The growers and farmers that produced the coffee, the conditions in which the coffee was grown, like the soil conditions, sunlight, and climate, and the subtle differences in the flavor coffee beans could produce depending on how they were prepared. During this third wave, concepts like farm to cup and single origin beans were popularized, and Matt Chittaranjan had been living in the Bay Area from 2003 to 2007, so he jumped into this movement head first during his time there. He even bought a small roaster and started preparing small batches of roasted coffee as a hobby, and so when he came to India in 2011 for a one-year job opportunity in Chennai, which happens to be the city where his dad is from, Matt spotted an opportunity. He saw the Cafe Coffee Days and Baristas of India and realized that coffee's third wave hadn't actually reached India yet, meaning that anyone who started a specialty coffee brand at that time would have a huge early mover advantage. It was in Chennai that Matt met his wife and co-founder Namrata Astana, and after moving to Delhi in 2012, they got to work setting up India's first homegrown specialty coffee brand, Blue Tokai. They set up a website, found a packaging company in Gujarat who would sell them bags to ship their product in, but of course, they also needed coffee. And as a startup with zero customers, this was an extremely difficult thing to do. They spoke to a number of growers asking if they could buy their coffee and sell it in India as a specialty product with the name of the estate on the packaging, but most growers didn't think that this would work. And there was actually one particular interaction with an estate owner that stands out in Matt's memory.
We explained the story, we said everything. He's like, nope. No, won't work. People in India, again, they don't care about quality right now. And you have to understand, all of these growers were exporting. So they were all very focused on finding buyers outside of India because that's where people understood that, okay, this is a quality product. We can pay a premium for it because we know that we'll be able to sell it for a premium to consumers. So he told us that, but interesting is that his son was in the room, during that conversation, and his son got it. His son was like, no, that's not dad. That's not what they're trying to do. They want to, do it as specialty. They want to highlight where it's from. They it's a very different concept. So it was interesting to sort of see that generational gap, happening. And then the interesting thing is that out of those six estates that we first started working with, we continue to buy coffee from them.
Okay, to this day.
So it's still very much a relationship-driven business. Obviously, every year we add on new estates, but those six growers, we still continue to buy coffee from.
Okay, so they ship you these bags of coffee, I'm guessing like big jute bags, yeah, 60 it comes kilo in 60 bags.
60 kg jute bag.
Yeah, and then you bring them back to your office, which is your wife's parents' house in Gurgaon.
Yeah.
And what's the next step? So you have like a coffee roaster, I'm guessing?
Yeah, so we had a very small 500 gram tabletop coffee roaster. We found it on the internet. There was some craftsperson in Taiwan who was making it. So we contacted him and he sent that over. We ended up again having to do a bunch of customs hassles for that, going to the post office and dealing with the people at the post office who are asking, what is this? What are you using it for? Then we got that set up. When we started, we were just operating out of a bedroom actually. So there was a table where the roaster was on, and then there would be I had another setup for the grinding. So I would be on one end of the room roasting the coffee. Then she would take it and grind it and package it and put it in the cardboard boxes and ship it out. It was a very much a mom and pop operation.
Is that safe though? I think roasters. Is there some kind of fumes from the cooking of the beans?
Yeah. So we had like a kind of makeshift exhaust going out the window, and there's a gas flame inside on the in like we would have failed FSSAI for sure if there was a inspection that happened. And then and actually her parents live in a residential colony, so you could, if you're walking during that time, you would be able to smell the aroma outside, and luckily none of the neighbors complained.
That's a good smell.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not sure, maybe that's not objective, but
it's pleasant.
Yeah,
it's pleasant.
I know you're sort of a stickler for quality, right? Ensuring that the beans are roasted exactly the right way. But I also know that India is a country where power cuts happen frequently, right? And a roaster is relying, unless you have like a diesel generator or something.
Yeah.
Most households do not have that.
Yeah.
Or an inverter, I guess, would that have worked or not really?
I mean, so it does work on the bigger roasters. On that small one, it didn't.
Okay. So what was that like? Because I'm guessing when the power goes out and you're in the middle of a roast, it's like it's toast.
Batch is gone.
How long does it take to roast one batch?
Anywhere from 9 to 13 minutes.
Okay. And is it expensive, or the raw beans are not that expensive?
So we've actually done a cost benefit on the bigger roasters for whether it makes sense to upgrade the inverter so that it's seamless and you won't lose any batch, versus just having to waste that coffee. And actually, the inverters are so expensive that you're better off just wasting the coffee.
Oh, seriously? Even to this day, this is a challenge?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow. So when the power goes out, there's nothing you can do. It's just...
So it'll last till the end of a roast. But if now we have to shut down production, though we do have generators in most places now, so then we can turn on the diesel generator and make sure production continues.
That must have been so frustrating though when it was just you and Namrata.
Yeah, like, because especially we're spending a lot of time roasting, and then it's just like, oh man, we got to do this again. That was a bit of a frustration.
Yeah, I'm sure. And you're sort of like staying up all night doing this stuff. It must have been exhausting.
Yeah, there was especially once we started getting the B2B orders, then there were times where we'd be roasting the entire night. And that was sort of, after that happened a few times, that's when we made the decision that, okay, this is not sustainable. We have to get a bigger roaster.
So how did you, okay, so it's online. Did you do any sort of marketing to like get the word out? Facebook, like, I don't know, like what would you have done to?
No, so we didn't do any like digital marketing. We did a lot of sort of on the ground, like events. We would participate in a lot of farmer pop-ups and physical events. That was the initial push came from that. And then very soon after, we started the B2B business, which in retrospect was quite silly. Like, we're roasting on a 500 gram roaster and pitching to get like 10, 20 kgs orders. But so then we did some just visiting businesses that we felt like who would be interested in a better quality product. And actually, there's a chain in Delhi called Lopra that was one of our first wholesale customers.
Okay. Financially, I know it probably didn't cost that much. You had to buy the roaster from Taiwan. That's an expense. But that, you know, the office is already there, right? Your in-law's house.
Yeah.
I guess getting the packaging might have been a small cost. Yeah, I think
it cost around 10 lakhs probably to get everything started up. And
you guys were like well enough off with your past work that you had done that you could afford that expense.
So I think by most of whatever we had saved, we put into this. Then it reached a certain point where we needed to get a bigger roaster, and roasters are quite expensive.
Right. That's what I wanted to know. That would have been the biggest. And that was the one that you guys had to get a crane to like.
Yeah.
So how expensive was that? That was a commercial roaster.
So at that point in time, they weren't being this quality. So it was a Probat roaster. Probat is sort of a global leader in coffee roasters. And now they make them in India. But at that point in time, it was only made in Germany. So then on top of the initial cost of the roaster, you had to pay duty, and that was significant. It cost around some 35, 40 lakhs. So that we had to borrow money from outside.
Okay. You hadn't brought that in terms of profit from the business at that point?
No, we were still at a very small scale. I think the calculus for us is, did we want to take this plunge and try and grow the business to a level that we'd be able to you know, get the ROI from that investment, or did we not? So
yeah, and what sort of, because I know about 6 months into the business, your wife Namrata became pregnant.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think there would have been a point where there's a fork in the road, right? You can either decide, you know what, this was a fun hobby project and we made, you know, we saw that there was a bit of demand, but, you know, this is not safe, right?
Yeah.
And maybe we should go the other route and get our jobs back or start working as consultants again.
Yeah.
You know, what was the point where you kind of decided, no, we feel like this is the right move to continue with this company?
So I think that we saw every day growth. So orders were steadily increasing. We had a decent response from B2B. And there was no one really who was doing kind of what we were doing. And so the bet was that ultimately India would sort of follow the trends that are happening across the entire world, where people, maybe not the majority of people, are drinking specialty coffee, but an increasing percent of the population wants to have that type of beverage. So that was sort of the bet that we had taken. So I think the initial, you know, the response from customers, the feedback that we got was all very encouraging. And so that gave us a lot of confidence that it wouldn't fail. Maybe it wouldn't become successful, but it wouldn't fail.
How confident would you say you were? I mean, were you like 100% sure this is going to happen? This culture is going to take off? Like now, 2023, in retrospect, obviously it did in a big way. It's huge,
yeah.
Right? But at that time, I'm sure there would have been like seeds of doubt too, right? Where you're like, I don't know if this is going to happen.
No, I actually, you know, I don't remember thinking that it won't work out. And I think, again, it came back from the feedback that we were getting, is that maybe if most of the feedback or even a significant proportion of the feedback was negative, that would have sort of sold those seeds. But because it was quite positive and it seemed like open space, that's how we took that plunge.
It felt like there was this latent demand that nobody else was meeting in this segment of the market.
Yeah, and I think the bigger decision came when we had to decide to look for outside funding, because that's once you sort of take that decision, that's something that you can't necessarily go back from. Like borrowing money from, you know, friends and family, you can manage that, but once you start taking outside capital, then you have to be much more confident that you're going to be able to repay that capital.
And you said it wasn't the big roaster that incentivized you to go out and raise capital. That was a family and friends round that you were able to raise the money to buy that roaster from?
Yeah.
Okay. So it was later on.
So that was in, actually fairly quickly, that was in 2000, within a year is when we moved to the bigger roaster. It was the next year that we started looking. So we were luckily Namrata's parents had a sort of a floor of or two rooms put together that were her dad's office. So they generously donated that to us. And again, so that was on the first floor, and we were in this residential house craning up a roaster into there. And then we had hired a few people, so there would be some, you know, I think four or five people at that point in time who were commuting to this house to work roasting and packing coffee.
That's so cool. Okay, so you're in Namrata's parents' house. And it sounds like the business was doing well. I mean, do you remember any of the financial figures from back then, 2013, 2014 period?
Yeah, I mean, we would have been doing maybe like just a few lakhs of business a month.
Okay.
Actually, it's interesting, for those first 2 years is when we were profitable. It's since then, once we raised the money, is when we stopped being profitable.
That's how it is. That's how it is.
But yeah, it was growing, you know, generating, like we were covering our expenses. And I think even paying ourselves a small salary after the second year.
I'm guessing things started to get a little crammed inside of your in-laws' house, right? Like you said, hiring people, four or five people, this coffee roaster, which never should have been there in the first place.
Yeah.
But obviously, like, you couldn't necessarily, doing a few lakhs, you know, per year, couldn't afford to move out, at least in the first few years, right? But eventually you do go out and raise a seed round from some investors.
Yeah.
And it was that the point where you decided that, you know, it's finally time to move out and actually get a proper commercial space?
Yeah, I mean, so ultimately we couldn't continue to operate from Namrata's parents' house. Not only the space constraint, but it's not, you know, not technically legal to do that. So we knew that we needed to move into a proper facility, and to do that we would need capital, and also just to grow the business generally. So we started reaching out to people that we knew, and through a friend of a friend got connected to Snow Leopard, which ultimately became our first investor.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think you've disclosed the amount that you raised for that seed round, have you?
It was three crores.
Okay. And that was enough to kind of set you up in your first commercial location?
So with that money, we started looking for spaces. We somehow stumbled upon this place in near Sake. It's called Se de la Job, which was just kind of warehouses, and they used to be chicken warehouses. So it was not and you have to go down this gully, and it's dirt road. It doesn't feel like a place that you would necessarily choose to open up a coffee roasting company. But
why did you choose that place?
Because it was cheap. And at that point in time, we weren't really necessarily thinking about cafes. We just needed space to roast coffee cheaply.
Yeah. Yeah. Cafes. Was that ever, in those early days, was that even like a thought?
It wasn't a part of so the initial pitch didn't really have a cafe component, like a heavy cafe focus. It wasn't something that we said we won't do, but it was not part of the main plan. And so actually that and if we had thought of opening cafes at that point in time, we would never chosen this location.
Right. Because you actually did at one point, you kind of set up a couple of tables and chairs, and you weren't selling food.
Yeah.
But it was sort of like a cafe in a space that I'm guessing wasn't was it legal to like operate a cafe?
Yeah. So it's a quasi-legal
gray zone.
It's a, you know, it's agricultural land, and so the landlords there, they sort of manage things so that people can open up cafes there, but there's a lot of areas of Delhi that are like this, but as you said, so we had some extra space within this place that we rented, and we thought, okay, fine, let's set up put up a machine. We had a counter that had a few seats. Again, we didn't have any food. And hired one or two baristas, and we sort of started serving coffee. We were fortunate in that, even though it looks like a total dump, that area, is that there's a lot of offices around there. So then people started, the office workers in the surrounding area started coming and really enjoying the cafe, the coffee that we were serving. Then that sort of led us to putting in a kitchen and then actually operating a proper cafe out of that location.
Now, I think it's important to note here that, like, this is, you said we had a little extra space. Like, this is literally like kind of a hallway sort of space, right? It was really.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the whole space was 1,800 square feet, and there maybe was a 200 square foot basically aisle on one side of the basically the roasting.
But this is amazing, because the fact that, first of all, you're getting all these customers that are just kind of discovering the place, loving the coffee. There's not even any food, right? So they're still coming just because they want the coffee.
Yeah.
What did that say to you? Like, was that like a light bulb?
Yeah. So I think from there, then it was okay. Then maybe we should put some effort into expanding the cafes and having cafes be a core part of the business.
Yeah, definitely.
So from there, we opened up Bombay. It was the same kind of roastery cafe concept. Again, super, super tiny place, very out of the way location. You had to go into this compound where there's no real natural footfalls. Actually, funny enough, there's a famous restaurant called Mask, and I had met the owners somehow before joining or before we decided to open up the roastery there. And it was at night, and they were showing me their space, and I was like, where are they taking me? This is like in the middle of nowhere. Who's gonna come here? And then we ended up opening our roastery just two doors down from them.
But that sounds like a really different strategy, right? I think a lot of the time, if you're thinking about expanding, adding new locations to it, basically creating a chain, you would typically just choose a nearby locality, maybe the opposite side of the city, sort of like everything normally happens in one city, at least for the first couple of years. Maybe you've got 5, 6, 7 locations, and then you think, yeah, let's expand to Mumbai, let's expand to other cities. You guys went to Mumbai like right away.
Yeah, because again, it wasn't a cafe-led strategy. A lot of the online orders were coming from Bombay. A lot of the B2B customers were in Bombay. And logistics then and continued to be like a pain. And people don't, especially on the B2B side, they don't think well enough in advance to order coffee. So it'll be like, coffee's out, I need coffee. But now if you're a Bombay customer and I'm roasting it in Delhi, I either have to airship it, which is going to be quite expensive, and even then it could take 1 or 2 days. Or if it goes by road and it's more cost effective, that'll take 3, 4 days.
Got it.
So that's why we chose to open the next location in Bombay.
That makes perfect sense. But I have to imagine, setting up in Delhi would have been, you guys are familiar with that space, right? You've got your in-laws, you've got a network, like people can advise you on how to make this happen, right? It's not easy to set up sort of a business, right? Set up an office, a commercial space, you're roasting stuff, you're selling stuff, people are drinking stuff, like there's rules and regulations, right? Did you face any challenges when you shifted to Mumbai and tried to set up this?
No, because we hired someone from Bombay who kind of led that. And but, now in retrospect, we got just royally ripped off, not through any fault of that person, but the person that we hired to do the licensing for us, they got us like fake licenses, and we only found out later, and it ended up...
The cops show up and they're like, where's your license? And you show them the license.
Yeah, and they're like, this is not applicable to this zone. He got a license for some other part of Bombay, and then that became a mess that we had to sort out, but... So I would say navigating that part of the business at especially as people who are not from the industry and not necessarily even familiar with India, that was a big learning, and definitely we got taken advantage of quite a few times.
So Matt's experience of opening cafes in the early days of Blue Tokai was clearly a difficult one. And if you're a restaurant owner, then you know how challenging operating dine-in outlets can be, which is why you should check Explorex out. Their operating system for restaurants, Bridge, makes running each location significantly more efficient. In the past, there was so much wasted time. A customer would come in, sit down, wait a couple of minutes for a menu, then wait for the server to place their order from that menu, then the server would need to remember the order or write it down, walk to the kitchen, and tell the kitchen staff what they needed to make. With Explorex, though, so much of that inefficiency is cut out of the process. So the customer sits down, they scan the QR code menu instantly, they place their order, and this order reaches the server's mobile phone through Bridge's MPO system, and then the server approves that order instantly, and it reaches the kitchen without any room for error. So this is all happening more accurately, more quickly, and more efficiently, and therefore revenue generation increases, which is ultimately how a restaurant will continue to thrive and grow. So if you're a restaurant owner and you're interested in trying Explorex and their operating system for restaurants Bridge out at your restaurant location, then click on the link in the description down below to learn more. All right, now on with the podcast.
Yeah. So what your business, this was by the time you shifted to Bombay, what year was it?
2015.
Okay. What percentage of your business at that point was B2B? How much of it was cafe? I'm sure it's like almost nothing.
Yeah.
And what was e-com?
At that point in time, cafe probably would have been around 10%. B2B would have been 30%, and e-com would have been 60%.
At that point, were you spending on marketing at all, or still word of mouth?
Yeah, still not really spending. It was only later when we brought on like an agency to, and I think that was 2 or 3 years later.
So I just had Bert Mueller on the podcast this like the last episode before your episode is going to go live.
Yeah,
and he was talking about how every time your business sort of doubles in size, you have to completely revamp your strategy.
Yeah.
And I think mainly that applies to operations, right? Operations are one of the most difficult.
Yeah.
Like you're a coffee guy, right? You're thinking about the product.
Yeah.
Your wife, Namrata, is also thinking about design and packaging and sort of like the brand image.
Yeah.
Operations, though, can be extremely challenging, and especially as you're growing as a business, it can get overwhelming, I think, and a lot of things can go wrong.
Yeah.
So how did you guys tackle that in this sort of 2015, 2016 time period?
Yeah, so out of those first five people, we had a team that could produce the product. But now, you know, we have multi-city operations, we are thinking of opening up more cafes, e-commerce, B2B. So at that point in time, we were looking for someone to be operations head. And we had put up a job posting, and this person, Shivam, he applied through LinkedIn, and he had this proposal of what he wanted to do and change, and he had really good energy, and so we hired him. Actually, he, I don't know, I have I'm somewhat harsh judge of people, and I feel like almost everybody that we've hired at some point in time, I felt, oh man, that was a mistake. We need we're gonna have to fire that person at some point. And I remember having that feeling with Shivam, and I remember having like a very difficult conversation with him 3 months in, where I was just like, I don't know if this is gonna work out. You really have to you know, change and get on board with what we're trying to do in the way that we wanted to do it. And he took that quite hard, it's just incredible just to see that what he's been able to do for us. So he took over sort of the cafe operations and you know, fit out of the spaces, the licensing, the even helped on some of the e-commerce and B2B operations. And really was transformative to our company. So much so that we made him a co-founder, I think, 4 years after he had joined. So we're really fortunate that the one that he applied, and two that I didn't fire him, because this business wouldn't be where it is without him.
Okay, so at some point, I guess it would have been around 2016, 2017, the cafe experience, I guess they're kind of experience centers in a way, right? You're sort of using that as part of your funnel to drive people to eventually buy from your online store.
Yeah.
But first they need to taste the coffee, and they do that at your cafe locations.
Yeah.
When did you guys finally decide, you know what, we're not going to let this just be an add-on where we have these commercial spaces and we're going to add a little cafe on the side.
Yeah.
We actually want to also be a cafe company. We want to be a dine-in sort of cafe restaurant experience.
So I would say from the first was the Delhi Roastery, then the Bombay Roastery, then the third cafe was a small kiosk in the Australian Embassy. Then after that is when we started opening up proper cafes, but it was still very much what you said, the focuses on these being customers acquisition, top of the funnel. Again, people will come, they'll taste the coffee, they'll like it, and we'll try and convert them to other parts of the business. And even up until, I would say, 2 years ago, is how we've sort of thought of cafes, is that, no, we're not necessarily a cafe company, and we're still not, but cafes we've always underplayed as part of the business, is that the cafes are sort of a necessary evil that we have so that we can grow the rest of the business. Now, I think where India is at in terms of cafe culture, actually cafes as a cafe business can do very well and are incredibly important. So that sort of mind shift has happened only fairly recently for us.
So was everything pretty much smooth sailing? I mean, you expand to Mumbai, you've raised this funding, you know, everything seems to be going well. Were there any moments along that journey between then and like the COVID-19 pandemic where, you know, it was a challenging experience that you guys faced?
I mean, there were lots of small challenges along the way, but I do remember one point when the Delhi government decided to go on a ceiling drive.
What's a ceiling drive?
They target places that they're not totally legal, and what they do is they put a lock on them. And it's very, like, once that happens, basically it's over, because it's the process to get something unsealed is very, very difficult and often doesn't happen.
And what was it about this is your Socket roastery location?
Yeah, so actually the first thing that got sealed was we signed up for a space in Defense Colony. And Defense Colony in Delhi is a very posh, upscale area. Not a place that you would think would ever be sealed, but we had signed up a lease there, done the fit out. We were about 2 days away from opening that cafe, and the government came in and they sealed it.
Because it was like a residential space, not a commercial space?
They were saying that anything on the first floor was illegal in that market.
Oh.
Which actually didn't seem technically true, because the landlord had paid for the conversion fees, and but you know, government being government, it's not always following.
Once the lock's on the door, that's it.
And then actually a few months later, they started coming to Sedelajab. And so there were rumors that, okay, they're coming to seal this area. And at that point in time, there were quite a few businesses that had opened up there. We were, because the success that we had brought in many other restaurants and cafes. So it seemed very likely that this could be an area that would be targeted, because, you know, it's La Aldora and not, it's only quasi-legal. So we started panicking at that point in time. You know, our main production was still happening in Delhi. And so what we did is we took the roaster out and we moved it back to Narmata's parents' house. So it was sort of like, oh man, we're going back in time 5 years now. And we couldn't like crane it up. It was too big. Now we had upgraded the size, so it couldn't go back to where it was. We had to create some makeshift thing outside of her parents' house. It was a nightmare. And that was sort of a wake-up call that, okay, we're way too large of a business now to be trying to mess around with La Aldora.
Yeah, you thought you're sort of an established company, but they're sort of bringing you back to the startup days.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. That would have been really stressful. Did they end up sealing the location?
No. And actually, to this day, so after that, we operated the cafe. I mean, so cafe we kept operating, because that would be very easy to remove that equipment, but we moved the roastery out right after that. But even now, we've stopped the cafe because it's just not worth taking the risk. Though there continues to be a ton of cafes operating in that area.
That's so cool. You guys were kind of the trendsetters, setting up this place on a sort of muddy dirt road, and then suddenly everyone else kind of follows suit.
Yeah, it was nice. It was cool to see the evolution, because in the beginning there were actually a lot of interesting brands that came. But then what happens in a lot of places, the landlords became greedy, and then they just started trying to bring in whoever was going to pay them the most money. And then it became very, a little bit down market, and didn't really have the same vibe that it had when we had the cafe there.
Yeah. And I think also this sort of changing culture around coffee was happening, you know, over the years, where it's becoming more and more common to see these premium outlets popping up. Like, I came to India in 2017. And I remember at that time I wouldn't say it was easy to find like just a nice pour over.
Yeah.
That's why I went to Blue Toka even back then. But now it's, you know, obviously the culture has changed quite a bit, and there's way more people. Like, the companies like Blue Toka have really educated the market and consumers in India on how to consume coffee in a way that isn't Cafe Coffee Day and Barista and Starbucks. 2019 was sort of the calm before the storm, right? The pandemic hits in 2020.
Yeah.
And I think this offline sort of dine-in experience had become a pretty important part of your business, right?
Yeah. It was around 2/3 of the business was coming from the cafes at that point.
Wow. What happened? Like, the pandemic hits March, or I guess February of 2020 is when it starts.
So lockdown happened in March. That was, you know, devastating for us as a business. All the cafes were shut. We were fortunate in that we had the e-commerce side of the business, and coffee got classified as an essential good. So we were able to get passes for the team to make sure that at least the e-commerce business could continue. So actually, now looking back, that was sort of a very surreal time to be driving to on the roads of Delhi that are totally empty, and passing police checkpoints and showing our essential worker passes for coffee. But that helped a lot. And the other thing that really changed once the lockdown eased a little bit is that even though dining wasn't allowed, that delivery was allowed. So up until that point, delivery was something that we hadn't really focused on. It was just sort of an afterthought. We'll put the listings up on Zomato and Swiggy, but it was contributing maybe 5% of the overall sales from the cafe. Obviously, during that lockdown time, it was 100%. But what was interesting is that it sort of led to a sea change in behavior. I think before, people didn't think of coffee as something that they would order from Zomato or Swiggy.
Yeah.
But now, even after all everything's opened up, it's still 33% of our business, and actually is growing. So that whatever happened in the pandemic, as people got used to the convenience of ordering on the apps. And even for myself, though I have access to all the coffee and equipment, there are often times where I'm at home and I just end up ordering an Americano from Blue Tokai just because it's so convenient.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's very convenient. I mean, it doesn't take that much longer to make it at home, but you know,
yeah,
you can't beat.
Sometimes, you know, you're just lazy.
Yeah, exactly. Pandemic starts to wind down in 2021. Now people, I think more than, this is really like the beginning. I feel like 2021, 2022, there's been this shift, at least that I've seen, where the love of coffee in this country is suddenly going way up, right? And not just like instant coffee and these sort of traditional methods of preparing,
yeah,
or like South Indian filter coffee, but actually like hardcore, you know, pour over, AeroPress, you know, nitro, like all these, you know, crazy ways of preparing coffee that used to be very sort of niche artisan, you know, experiences. Now it's actually becoming pretty mainstream.
Yeah.
So as the pandemic is winding down and people are deciding like, okay, I'm going to go out and go back to a cafe for the first time, how did you guys differentiate yourselves from some of the other offerings that were out there?
Yeah. So I think for us, it's always been about the product. It's never been about going to a cafe for a cafe. It's been about serving as good a coffee as we can and telling people what goes into that. So how is that coffee sourced? Who's growing it? What are they doing at the farm level to make it taste the way that it does? How are we roasting it? And then ultimately, how are we brewing the coffee? I would say even if you come to our cafes now, the experience at the cafe has much more scope to improve rather than the product. The product is very good, but you know, we could do and we're working on doing a better job on the experience side. But people who are coming to us are not necessarily coming to us to be at a cafe. They're coming for that coffee. And I think that's always been a differentiator for us.
So this space now is really starting to heat up. I've been sort of hinting at this throughout the conversation. And it's kind of amazing to look at where the industry has gone from 2012 until today. I'm sure it's reminiscent of what you experienced back in 2002, 2003 with this sort of revolution that happened in the American coffee ecosystem as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, as things heat up, obviously competition also becomes a factor. And I think Blue Tokai used to be sort of like the one brand, right? Like everyone just knew if you want great coffee in India, Blue Tokai is where you go. Blue Tokai is where you order from. Whereas now there are a couple of different companies that are sort of moving into your territory.
Yeah.
So how do you guys look at or handle competition? What are the things that you're doing to stay competitive and sort of expand your TAM?
Yeah. So I think one thing about competition in India versus competition in the US is that because of the stage that it's at, even in India where things are heating up, there's actually, I don't think, very few companies who are doing exactly what another company is doing. Whereas in the US, there would be many coffee companies who are doing something very similar to what we're doing. Here in India, all of the competitors are doing things a little bit differently. So they have, you know, different product strategy, different way of marketing, different segment that they're approaching. And so that means that there's very little direct competition. And actually, it's beneficial because it's really growing the market for everyone. There's actually this place in one of our cafes in Delhi where there's a Blue Tokai, then there's a Chaios, then there's a Starbucks, then there's a Third Wave, all in one line. And actually, as these brands have opened up, our sales have actually grown. And they're also doing good business too. So what that tells you is that it's really expanding the market right now rather than stealing market share from other companies. And I think for us, we feel that as long as we continue to just focus on what we do and kind of put our blinders on and execute, then we'll be fine. The way that we sort of approach things is going to be different than any one of these other brands, and there's plenty of market available for everybody to succeed.
Definitely. But at the same time, I feel like does increase in demand and increase in sort of the end point of the coffee journey, which would be a cafe or a bag of coffee in someone's kitchen, do the farmers sort of increase their ability to supply that demand? Or is there sort of like limited agriculture space and limited beans to go around? Like, is this going to drive up the price of coffee in India?
Not yet. So I think especially on the grower side, most of the people who have been involved in specialty have been focused on the export market. And so now, because at that up until, you know, really until we started, there was no really demand or no outlet for them to sell their coffee domestically. So what's happening is, one is that it's easier for growers to find domestic buyers. So it, they don't have to spend the effort going to all these trade shows outside and trying to market them and competing with coffee from all around the world. So they have a sort of a natural linkage to sell the coffee to domestic players. And the other thing is that because commodity coffee prices up until this recent spike have been at a level where it's not really very lucrative and in some cases not even sustainable to grow coffee. So growers are looking for a way that they can access the specialty market because one, you get a premium, and two, there's far less price volatility there. So that's what's leading to an increase in supply on the specialty end. And still, even for us, every year we're finding new estates to work with. So we've only kind of scratched the surface of that. And another thing that we've started doing is engaging more with small scale growers. So a lot of the coffee that we buy currently are from kind of bigger estates, because ultimately you need capital, knowledge, space in order to produce specialty coffee. Whereas small scale growers, they don't have those things. So what we've done in Tamil Nadu and in Andhra is we've identified areas that have good quality coffee cherries who are typically just selling that to local traders and not necessarily realizing the full value of that. And so we've worked with them, helped them a little bit on coffee cherry selection, and set up very small scale processing units nearby.
And they couldn't set up those processing units themselves.
It's not viable for one grower to do that, because it's not just about setting up the unit. It's about also having an outlet to sell that coffee to achieve the premium, because ultimately specialty coffee costs more to produce. So if you're putting in the effort to produce specialty coffee and you have to sell it at the commodity rate, then you're losing on both ends. So it's about both giving them the expertise and then giving them access to the market for them to get better quality, better price for the quality that they're growing.
That's interesting. What have you guys noticed about that alternative way of sourcing coffee? Has it been like significantly more lucrative? Is there a path where Blue Tokai actually makes this a large part of their sourcing?
Yeah, so it requires a lot of effort because they don't know us. They already have established relationships with traders. So on the one hand, the traders are trying to block us from coming in there because we're ultimately taking their product. So they're not happy with us. And on the other hand, the growers, you know, they're quite skeptical. So to set up that one location in Tamil Nadu, that required, I think, 5 or 6 town hall meetings with the growers and a lot of politics going on. And we had to rope in one of the larger growers who had relationships with them to vouch for us. So it requires a lot of effort to do that. But ultimately, the coffee that came out of that was very good.
You guys benefit. The growers benefit. They actually get more money for their coffee, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So
the only people that are disadvantaged here are the
traders.
The traders. Which are dangerous people to piss off.
You don't necessarily want to be on the bad side of them, but at the same time, it's a free market, so people should be able to sell their product to whoever they can get the most value for.
Are there any, is there sort of like a tax that you guys pay, like on a...
No, we haven't. What had happened is that the traders were coming in and then offering more money. So that the initial price that we were expecting to get the cherries at, we ended up having to pay more because the traders were bidding up that price, which is fine. Like, that's fair enough. That's how economics works, right?
So one thing that I think is really cool is the fact that you guys are not just sort of... now that you're an established brand, people are familiar with Blue Tokai, but you're not just sort of sitting back and sort of not innovating, right? You've actually done a lot of R&D. You're releasing all kinds of different products, like a lot of FMCG stuff.
Yeah.
You've got canned coffee now. You've got this pour over device mechanism thing where you sort of put it on the top of the cup and pour the water through.
Yeah.
There's cold brew packets. You sell equipment for people who want to do coffee at home. I don't think you manufacture that stuff yourself,
no.
But you're sort of acting as a middleman, making sure that people can get it all in one place, which is awesome. And it seems like that's actually becoming a pretty important part of your business, diversifying in all these directions.
Yeah, so I think in order to grow the market, especially on the specialty side, people have this idea in their head that it's very difficult to make a good cup of coffee. you have to invest in a lot of equipment and you have to know brewing recipes, and that's sort of a barrier, even though that doesn't necessarily have to be that way. You can just make coffee very simply. And when I make coffee at home, I don't often use a scale. I just eyeball it, and most of the time it turns out quite well. But the idea with the products is to bring convenience to people who are looking for quality. So with the easy pours, then that's sort of self-contained. You don't need to invest in anything. You can just put that over your cup and pour it through. Canned coffee is something that's taken off in the specialty market across the world, and it's not really available here in India. So that's what we wanted to do, is have just ready to drink as a convenience option for people who don't want to brew at all. Same with Nespresso capsules. Again, that's a convenience-based thing. And I think everywhere people, it's not just in India, everywhere people appreciate convenience. That being said, at the same time, the still what sells the most is the coffee packets. So these are good kind of gateways into getting people to brewing coffee at home. Because ultimately these easy pours, you can bring your cost down dramatically if you just buy a pour-over cone for 500 rupees and the filter is 2 rupees. So you can cut your cost in half if you just buy the coffee bag and brew the pour-over at home. So the idea with a lot of this is to make good coffee more accessible and just have a solution for everyone.
So in January of 2023, this year, you guys raised 200 crore rupees in your Series B round. Big moment. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Very exciting. What is that money enable you guys to do? Because I think there's been some discussion or conversation around global as well, right?
Yeah. So actually, for us, the focus is still on India. We just see that there's so much potential here. We did start Blue Tokai in Japan. So we do have a roastery there. Actually, one of our roasters from India moved to Japan, and he oversees the coffee program there. We sell online, B2B. We have right now we have some pop-up kiosks, and we're in the process of setting up our own cafe there. Japan's an interesting market. It's the second or third largest coffee-consuming country in the world. And it's very similar in that specialty has started, but is in a growth phase. It's not, you know, as prevalent as it is in other places. But for us, the focus with the money that we raise has really been on growing our presence in India. This is we just see so much potential here. We feel kind of is at the cusp of really taking off. You know, last 10 years have been spent building brand, raising awareness, helping, trying to drive growth and specialty. And now is really the time where we see an inflection point for coffee in India.
You guys started off as a profitable company in the early days. And then I think as soon as you guys raised venture capital, then obviously the priority becomes growth, and profitability is oftentimes it's actually discouraged when it comes to venture capital, because that means that you're sort of leaving, there's some growth that you could be achieving that you're not.
Yeah.
But now it seems like you are moving in that direction where you guys actually want to become profitable at some point in the near term. So what are the most difficult, what are the challenges that you guys are facing in getting to that point at this stage in your journey?
I mean, so even for us, we kind of looked at things differently, is that we've always been very cognizant of what the burn has been at the company level. So even after we raised money, we were growing and still trying to keep the burn at around 5%. So we never really pursued this hyper growth, hyper burn path that a lot of, you know, D2C or consumer companies do once they raise. But even for us, this is a hard business. You have to really pay attention to every single small thing and put in place processes and people, because every 25 basis points here, 50 basis points there is what really makes a difference between running it profitably and not. And I think one of the challenges in this business in particular is that on the one hand, you do have some supply constraint because India has import duty on coffee. So our core raw material can only come from growers within India, and it only happens once a year. The harvest only happens once a year. So if there's some weather patterns changing, and that can all lead to stress within that system. It's not that we can just easily replace the coffee with coffee from Africa or South America.
And coffee is a very sensitive crop too.
Yeah. So especially Arabica, it requires rainfall at the right time and a right amount of rain, but not too much rain, sun at the right time. So it's a very particular and difficult crop to grow. So that's on the sort of the sourcing side, is there's some constraints there. And then if I look at in the cafe side of the business, we're competing with restaurants, with bars for the same spaces. So the APC, the average check that we're cutting is not going to be the same as what a full-scale restaurant can be. So we have to be very cognizant about keeping our real estate costs in check. And that's the, you know, one of the key determinants towards whether the cafe is profitable or not is what's your rent to revenue ratio. Then apart from that, manpower is a significant cost for us. It's, you know, traditionally people thought of baristas as, you know, anybody can, you, if you get fancy equipment, anybody can press the button and make a cup of coffee. And well, that's not the case. It takes skill and we have to train people in order to make coffee properly and to be able to explain to everybody what's the difference between our coffee compared to what people have traditionally seen. So training those people and upskilling them to deliver the experience that we want, that again becomes a cost for us. So there's not a lot of levers that we have for profitability, which is why you really have to be pay attention to everything and really be on it. It's really a mindset thing more than anything, is that making sure that, you know, every rupee is accounted for and you really have a tight control on that.
Wow. That sounds really difficult. You really just have to like refine things further than...
Yeah, there's no magic bullet. It's not like, okay, fine, if I just cut labor costs by 5%, then I'll be sorted. It's about, I have to look at everything holistically and identify where can I get 50 basis points across many different things and then monitor those and be on top of those.
Yeah. As a venture-backed business, at some point, right, you're going to have to give your investors an exit, which, you know, I'm not even sure if that was something that you, I'm sure you were aware of it. You had worked in finance in the past, right? You know how these things work.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm actually curious to know, like, is there a part of you that thinks like, you know, maybe it would have been better to go the bootstrapped route and just sort of build this thing without external capital? Or would it not have been possible?
Yeah, it's too capital intensive. So just opening an outlet cost 70 to 90 lakhs. So I don't come from a wealthy family, and number that doesn't either. So accessing, doing things just through whatever money we have was not an option. So there was a point in time before we raised our seed round where we thought, okay, maybe we'll move to Goa, turn this into a lifestyle business and just roast, you know, have one cafe and roast coffee near the beach.
That would have been nice. Go surfing on the weekends.
Yeah. So I would say I used to think about that. Pre-pandemic, I would think about that choice more. I think after pandemic, I haven't even considered it at all. Like I think I would be miserable. Like if I were to see someone else make a Blue Tokai, then I would have been like, oh man, that could have been me. I should have chosen the other path.
Yeah, you guys were so acutely aware of the opportunity in front of you.
Yeah,
and realizing how few people realized that opportunity as well. So now, right, eventually you're going to have to give your investors an exit, either going the IPO route at some point or being acquired, basically, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think obviously IPO will be much more, a better outcome, just in terms of what the value that you'll unlock from that versus an acquisition. And we actually see a very clear path for that, happening for us. So I mentioned, you know, all of the things that we're trying to do to work on profitability, and we see a very clear path to us reaching 15 to 20% EBITDA margins, at a, you know, at a decent scale. And at that point, that becomes a very attractive, IPO. There's actually very few consumer, brands, who are publicly traded, and those that are because of, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities to access them. The multiples are quite favorable.
That's very exciting. You as a founder have obviously changed over the years, 2012 until today, 2023. It's been a long journey. Yeah. What's one thing that you were really bad at when you started the company that now you're actually quite good at and, you know, proud of yourself for growing so much as an entrepreneur?
I mean, I would say I still have a lot to grow in terms of being a entrepreneur. I think one thing that I have gotten a lot better at is saying no. You know, especially not, this being the first time I started a business, not being from the industry, So whether it's, you know, growers or, you know, other industry professionals or even investor calls, I would always say, yes, I'll do it. And now, having been doing this for a larger amount of time, like time is actually very valuable. And I've really come to appreciate that. So now I say no to a lot of things, become much more focused and I would say more confident in my understanding my ability to be able to execute and not having to listen to everybody.
Talking about IPO, it also brings into question, you know, your role in the company. And, you know, you've been doing this now for more than a decade. Yeah. Is there any part of you that feels like, you know, I'd kind of like to do something new, or I just want to take it easy, maybe retire, relax, whatever? Or are you still pretty energetic and ready to keep going with this company?
Yeah, so I look at it that it has been 10 years, and actually that's by far the longest I've ever been in any not even just one position, but any industry. So I've always been someone who sort of jumps around after 2 years looking for the next thing. And actually, when I came to India initially, I thought I'd come here for a year, do this job, and then move on to another assignment. But now, having spent 10 years doing this, I feel like actually we've just laid the groundwork for what's going to come next. I mentioned, I think, earlier that I feel that India is really, just as a country and also within coffee, at a sort of inflection point. You know, I think India, the growth path that's ahead of it is very exciting. And I just see so much opportunity in coffee going forward that I'm nowhere ready to give it up. I think the only way I would consider that is if someone is able to do, if I'm not able to do justice to that opportunity. Maybe this reaches a certain scale where someone can do that better than me. But for now, I see, like, very excited about what's ahead.
That was Matt Chittaranjan, co-founder of Blue Tokai. And by the way, even though Matt's entire business revolves around the brewing of coffee, Matt has actually been known to brew other things in his spare time as well.
Before starting Blue Tokai, you were experimenting a lot with beer, brewing beer, just as like a hobby, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a future where we might see some kind of like Blue Tokai brewery?
I mean, I'm still very passionate about beer. Now it's mostly drinking rather than brewing. Pre-pandemic, we used to set up a little home brewery in the office, and so I got the team brewing beer, and that was sort of a fun kind of engagement for us. And now we've actually collaborated with Bira on a few coffee beers. So that's sort of where that outlet is. I don't see us in the future moving towards a brewery, but we would maybe look at serving beer in the cafe in some locations.
Okay. A man can only hope.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for watching or listening to the podcast this week, and I'll catch you in the next one.